Hi, hello there.
Howdy.
Hello, can you hear me?
Don't do that.
It's me. I see this girl on TikTok all the time at nighttime when I'm scrolling. She does these lives and it's literally her in front of the microphone doing weird shit like.
And see, I watch stuff like that. I listen to it to fall asleep because of my tinnitus and everything now. But I'm having a fight with Apple Music right now that nothing is more disorienting than imagine yourself in bed listening to like people crinkling wrappers, making mouth sounds, and like haircuts and things. And then all of a sudden, in this random radio shuffle of ASMR, someone just starts pornographically moaning in your ear. And you look up and it's like porn ASMR. What?
Wait, on Apple Music.
It's a thing.
They have, well, of course it's a thing. They have porn ASMR just fully on Apple Music for like anyone.
Yes, they do. But the thing is, it's not so much that I hate the moaning. I hate how bored she sounds.
Oh, no. Well, yeah, I guess she can't be too excited because then it's like, oh, I'm not tired anymore. Mm-hmm. Like, it's time to watch porn.
It definitely wakes me right up out of like the comfortable zone I was in. So I have to hit next.
You're frantically trying to hit next. Mommy, sorry.
Oh, God.
I didn't know that was a thing. And I don't love that you've told me that it's a thing.
There are a lot of things that are things that I wish were not things. And that is one of them. So,
yeah, that's fair. Speaking of pornography.
What a segue.
No, that's not a segue. I mean, sometimes we do kind of like delve into that realm, like very briefly. We like dip our toes in there.
Get our feet wet.
Literally. We are here today to talk about saints and witches. I'm Sarah.
I'm Liz.
I'm a Catholic.
And I'm a witch.
And today we're going to talk about saints and witches in Germany again.
We are back in Germany.
Germany is just kind of, it's like an unending wealth of weird shit in like the Middle Ages. I love it.
They made a lot of saints. They killed a lot of witches. So
they killed a lot of saints too.
They indiscriminately killed a lot of people for a long time.
They sure did.
A long time.
Yeah, too soon. As I was saying it, I was like, yeah, they still, huh? Yeah, they still continue to do that, huh?
Sorry, Germany.
There's a theme in Germany. Which is just like senseless murder and destruction.
One could argue that's also the theme of America.
Yeah, that is fair. But there's also like beer and wine in Germany. So
they do have more culture than we do.
Yeah, a lot more culture. Our culture is just like, what do we have?
White people with dogs and strollers.
Dogs and strollers, like purebred dogs and strollers too.
Very specifically purebred dogs.
Yeah.
That costs like $4,000.
Yeah. And that you have to like drive cross country to go get. Mm-hmm. What else do we have?
We have a bunch of recipes where everyone puts crack in the name.
Crack chicken casserole. It's like, write what you know, Deborah. Like, obviously never done crack. If you would, you wouldn't be comparing it to this chicken with like, and it has like 6 blocks of cream cheese and like a whole bag of shredded cheddar, like, yeah. And somehow that's crack. I don't know, like 2 tablespoons of garlic powder or something, and then you just like put it in the crock pot. We have casseroles, we have tailgating,
we have school shootings.
That's part of our culture.
It is at this point.
Yeah, unfortunately. Yeah, I just remembered last time or the time before, or I don't know, we were talking about how we used to daydream about getting murdered in school.
Yeah, that's what happened. Is I was trying to think of something positive, and that was the intrusive thought that I had is when we talked about school shootings. So
yeah, that's American culture, is dreaming about getting murdered.
Another part of our culture is driving absolutely everywhere. Oh, it's only 14 hours away. That's so easy.
And also driving like a quarter mile away to the store.
Yeah.
Because it's like, I can never walk 500 feet, but I'll drive for 36 hours. Yep. The obesity epidemic, that's American culture.
I participate in that.
I'm working my way up there. Let me tell you, this pandemic, oh my God.
I have saved room for you.
I now am at the point, I don't know if it's gaining weight or if it's aging or it's a combination, the ripe old age of 26, but I'm now at the age where I make noises, involuntary noises, every time I like change my seating position. Not even when I stand up, like obviously that, but like even just like shifting around, I'm like, I don't know. I don't get it. Enough about me.
I'm going to hop straight in today. There are four really big trials whenever you search up Germany. There are the Trier trials of the late 1500s, the Fulda trials of the early 1600s, and the Würzburg trials of 1626 to 1631, contemporary with the Bamberg trials of 1626 to 1631, the latter of which is the subject for today.
Okay.
This does put us in Bavaria today, a southern state in Germany. It puts us there in the early 1600s, meaning we are in the same state in general time period as the Pappenheimer trial I talked about way back in episode 10, might be a turtle, might be a vagina.
That was the sad one about the family, the poor family who were, what was their jobs?
They were beggars and like garbage men. They cleaned laboratory stuff like that. So
yep, I remember the shit cleaners. That was what their name means.
Mm-hmm. The Pappenheimer trial took place in Munich, Bavaria, in the year 1600. So some of this background and context is just going to be refresher.
Okay.
One of the men you might remember is a guy with a really long name that I'm going to try to say, Johann Georg Fuchs von Dornheim.
Wow.
Yeah, what a name. And he's the second. So.
Oh, wow. Generational trauma.
He is the Prince Bishop of Bavaria. He is also known as the Hexenbrenner or the Hexenbischof, the Witch Burner, the Witch Bishop.
I remember that.
Mm-hmm. We also have over the area Maximilian I, who you called Million.
Million, yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Max was the Duke of Bavaria during the Pappenheimer trial. He is the Elector of Bavaria during Bamberg. I do not know the difference between a duke and an elector. Don't ask me what the difference is. I didn't Google it. I didn't care.
Okay.
Max, for anybody who needs more of a refresher today, is the guy who marries his niece, the daughter of Holy Roman Emperor Ferdinand II. Max also has a brother named Ferdinand, a prince bishop, who is in charge of Liège during the Belgian spa trials. They talked about in episode 9, the penis nest is an illusion, which I say with the straightest of faces.
The penis nest is an illusion. Okay, I remember Liège because I have a lot going on in Liège too. Not today, but like I I, the Catholic Church.
You personally have invested a lot in Liège.
I have. Listen.
She has business dealings in Liège.
I have several. I have a plethora of dealings with the Diocese of Liège.
I don't know everything about Sarah.
You never will.
Anyway, everything always comes together. It's like a weird circle. Everything's connected. That's the show. Mm-hmm. But there's your context. So we are going to slip into Bamberg, 1626. Bamberg is a city in northern Bavaria that's pretty neat. It was the center of the Holy Roman Empire at one time. A saint is buried there, which I did not know until like the last day of my research.
Is it Saint Otto?
What is her name? It's Kunigund or something like that.
Yeah, I know her.
Back from like, what is it, the 12th century? It was a while ago.
Yeah, an old one.
As her name would suggest.
Right.
It's not like Brittany.
Saint Brittany. I don't think we have a Saint Brittany yet, but maybe. Maybe I could be wrong. I could be wrong.
Bamberg is also a UNESCO World Heritage Site, and it's celebrated being 1,000 years old back in 1973. So not recently.
Yeah.
Like 50 years ago, it was 1,000 years old.
Mm-hmm.
But at this point in time, it's a Catholic area caught in the middle of the post-Reformation, the Counter-Reformation, and the 30 Years' War. And bonus, the weather has not been great, with bad frosts and cold snaps that damage crops and are heightening already high tensions.
Mm-hmm.
Extra bonus, economic issues. Extra bonus, the plague is still doing its thing. So there's a lot going on. None of it's good. And we all know that in times of tragedy, humans like to just pile on and kind of see what they can get away with.
Yep.
So why not a trial in Bamberg when millions of people are dying? What's a few more? So the Bamberg trials are well documented. We have trial documents, prison menus, and interrogation protocols. It's weird.
Prison menus.
Yeah, it's very strange. But could you imagine it? Imagine for a second being a witch. You're like strung up to the ceiling by chains, and they're like, "Would you like the chicken or the fish?"
What's the fish? I'm sick of salmon.
What are the sides though? That'll determine my entree.
Well, the chicken comes with a lovely crust of bread, and the trout comes with
a nice rice pilaf.
raw potato. What kind of potato? Like, really getting into it.
Mm-hmm. One of the most well-documented cases in the Bamberg trials is that of Johannes Junius. Johannes had been burgermeister or mayor of Bamberg several times in 1614, 1617, 1621, and most recently from 1624 to 1628. And when he wasn't burgermeister, he was serving on the city council. So it's not like he was mayor and then he just went home and did whatever. He's pretty much just trading out between those positions.
Mm.
One thing you will find in German trials is that they truly do not give a fuck who you are. They don't care about your family. They don't care about your money. They don't care about your titles. You're not off limits. In fact, you are probably desirable for your confiscatable wealth.
Ooh.
Yeah. Because witch trials are expensive because you got like the firewood and you got to pay everybody involved and their prison costs. It's a thing. It's an actual thing.
I believe it. It's just funny. Funny in a very sad way.
Mm-hmm. But all of these costs kind of stack up. And so if you start going after people who have a lot of wealth and you can get them to give it up, or you can take it from them in some way, then you can use it to not only finance the trials, the money you've already spent, but then you have extra. So Johannes comes under scrutiny in June 1628. His wife had been executed for witchcraft in the past, and this paired with another burgermeister of the area accusing Johannes of witchcraft while that man was imprisoned for witchcraft, leads to Johannes's June 1628 arrest.
Mm.
Johannes is imprisoned in a building called the Drudenhaus, or the Witch Prison.
Ooh.
Everything in German just sounds so, like, gloomy.
It's a gloomy sounding language, for sure. And I just love the absolute audacity that they have in just shoving words together to make new words.
The sick wagon for ambulance.
Krankenwagen.
Yes. And what are gloves? Hand shoes?
That's not surprising to me at all.
No, I love those so much. And yeah. Skull is like death's head.
That's so cool.
Mm-hmm. I enjoy it.
German, we like your language.
I don't like saying it.
Start over. You get it.
You know what we're trying to say.
Right.
The Drudenhaus was constructed in 1627 on Dornheim's orders. So the dude with the really long name. And is torn down in 1635. So a couple years after the trials. It no longer exists, but we do have a picture of it, a diagram of it. So we know what it looked like.
Mm-hmm.
It had 26 single cells and then two big cells for groups of people, according to sources, and was decorated with biblical passages. The building inscribed with, "Let it be a reminder of justice from which the gods cannot ignore," which is a quote from Virgil. So,
wow.
This very cheery place to be taken to the witch prison of all places, and then there's just Bible passages all over the fucking place.
Mm. Scary.
I'm not a fan.
No.
A quick note on my sources. I'm using a few today, but a big one in regard to Johannes comes from the Hanover Historical Text Collections Project, which I just discovered, and I think it's really cool, and I wish I'd found it for earlier episodes.
Mm.
It's Hanover College's online digital HTML collection of stuff from Salem, the French Revolution, Greece, the Enlightenment, all kinds of stuff. And this collection has trial notes for Johannes and a letter of his, which is unique and important, and I'll get to why later. This letter has multiple translations into English, though, and is excerpted differently by everybody. So I did read several versions of the letter, one being the Hanover version, another being an appendix in the work, Male Witches in Early Modern Europe. That's pretty good, and I do recommend that version highly. And it's free on the internet. Anything I ever tell you guys you can find is free. I'm not spending money on this.
Right. Yeah. Same with everything I talk about, unless it's like a book that I somehow already had or like stole from my mom or something.
Or the book was the only source and for some reason it was only $3. And usually these books are like $81 for an ebook, which makes no sense.
Crazy.
Another quick aside to anyone who might go reading about these trials after this episode, there is a book out there by a guy I stayed clear of using. It is cited on Wikipedia, and the guy is on YouTube, and he has a website, and he pushes this interactive book, which it is neat, but nowhere does he openly cite his sources or experts or images. I did skim some of his stuff enough that I could tell when people were using him as a source in their stories, because they would mention a fact that I'd only seen with that guy. But this is just me saying, you know, be careful who you trust to educate you, and also maybe exercise a little bit of skepticism anytime a stranger on the internet is trying to sell you something without credentials.
That's just like generally good advice.
Back to Johannes. Johannes's story, I think you'll find, is very similar to Walpurga Hausmann's from episode 16, A Baby Is Not a Juice Box. And I am just having fun saying all the names of our old episodes right now. So
that episode's one of my favorites.
It's a good episode. It's a very good episode.
Mm-hmm.
His story will start out reminiscent of Agatha Shipton, a beautiful man secretly, the devil approaching her on the side of a river, which that's episode 14, Synthesize and Bastardize. But overwhelmingly, the story is similar to Walpurga. Mm-hmm. And this is just something that normally I don't read things and I'm just so heavily reminded mm-hmm. of other trials. Mm-hmm. It might just be like, oh, I've seen this element in like 17 of the stories that I've talked about. Like, it doesn't bear repeating. But this is like a carbon copy almost of this story. You could swap out the names in places and it would be the same story. Mm-hmm. So a refresher on Walpurga, I don't know. I said Walpurga during that episode and that's what I'm going to stick with. Mm-hmm. So she was the one who really just wanted to bang her neighbor.
oh yeah.
really just wanted to fuck her neighbor. And a demon disguises itself as the neighbor and shows up and has sex with her instead. It eventually reveals its form and manipulates Walpurga into a contract, and it is abusive at any signs of her faith. At one point in the story, it makes her ride a pitchfork with it to a meeting with the devil, where Walpurga is forced to renounce God, is baptized by the devil, and is given a new name. Her demon also gets a name. Remember that as I start talking about Johannes. And it's if you go on to our lovely, lovely Instagram, I do believe that demon Kevin Federline is associated with this episode. If that's any draw for you to go listen or re-listen to that episode.
Oh my gosh, I had forgotten completely about Kevin Federline. But I stand by making him into a demon. I don't feel any remorse about that.
It is hands down the best edit I have ever done of a photo. So, Johannes's trial transcripts read, and I will be quoting large portions of things today, but also skipping over things and sentences. Quote, on Wednesday, June 28th, 1628, was examined without torture Johannes Junius, burgomaster at Bamberg, on the charge of witchcraft, how and in what fashion he had fallen into that vice. Is 55 years old and was born at Niederwesig in the Wetterau. None of my stuff has, I couldn't look up most of the pronunciations in the story. Mm-hmm. They just don't exist. Sorry.
Yeah.
Says he is wholly innocent, knows nothing of the crime, has never in his life renounced God, says that he is wronged before God and the world, would like to hear of a single human being who has seen him at such gatherings as the witch Sabbaths. And I like that last line because the phrasing definitely sounds like they're just indirectly quoting his rants at them.
Mm.
Would like to hear of a single human being who has seen him.
Yeah.
I can definitely just see him like a male version of a Karening.
Yeah. Name me one single human who has seen me there. Yeah.
And they're like, here's 15.
Okay. You asked. Like, that backfired.
It continues, quote, confrontation of Dr. Georg Adam Hahn tells him to his face he will stake his life on it that he saw him, Junius, a year and a half ago at a witch gathering in the electoral council room where they ate and drank. Accused denies the same wholly. End quote. And a brief interlude, the man mentioned here, Georg Hahn, is another higher profile Bamberg case. Hahn was a councilman who openly opposed the Bamberg trials. So while he was gone on a business trip 1 month, the authorities arrested Hahn's wife and daughter, tortured them, and Hahn came back to find that the two of them had been executed in his absence. He was then arrested and executed for witchcraft himself, along with several of his children.
Oh my God.
Another name you might come across in the Bamberg trials is Dorothea Flock. She was the second wife of a councilman and was arrested while she was heavily pregnant. Her family had connections and petitioned for her release, easing of detention, and her ability to have counsel, but the warrants kept going ignored. when her family kept petitioning and they involved people even higher in the legislative ladder, the prince bishop finally sent a notice that the baby had been delivered a while ago and was fine, and that Dorothea was locked up again in the Druden house. And finally, her family got approval for her release, but Dorothea had confessed to witchcraft in the meantime under torture. The authorities knew that this mandate for her release was on its way, and so they bypassed the pre-execution torture for Dorothea and executed her swiftly 30 minutes before the mandate arrived.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, and she's one reason the trials underwent scrutiny and ended, because they deliberately went out of their way to kill this woman, regardless of what the authorities wanted.
Yeah, sorry, that's not upholding the law. Like, that's not, just say what you really mean. Say what you say what your real purpose is, you know?
Definitely. The trial notes continue with who confronts Johannes and what they accuse him of: going to Sabbaths, desecrating holy wafer, and go on to say, quote, on Friday, June 30th, 1628, the aforesaid Eunice was again without torture exhorted to confess, but again confessed nothing, whereupon, since he would confess nothing, he was put to the torture. And first the thumb screws were applied. Says he has never denied God his Savior, nor suffered himself to be otherwise baptized. Will again stake his life on it. Feels no pain in the thumb screws. Leg screws. Will confess absolutely nothing and knows nothing about it. Has never renounced God, will never do such a thing, has never been guilty of this vice, feels likewise no pain. Is stripped and examined. On his right side is found a bluish mark, like a clover leaf, is thrice pricked therein, but feels no pain and no blood flows out. Strapado. He has never renounced God, God will not forsake him. If he were such a wretch, he would not let himself be so tortured. God must show some token of his innocence. He knows nothing about witchcraft. On July 5th, the above named Eunice is without torture, but with urgent persuasions exhorted to confess, and at last begins and confesses. And here is where you should listen for similarities to Walpurga's story, and also to Shipton. So, quote, when in the year 1624, his lawsuit at Rothweil cost him some 600 florins, he had gone out in the month of August into his orchard at Friedrichsbrunnen. And as he sat there and thought, there had come to him a woman like a grass maid, who had asked him why he sat there so sorrowful. He had answered that he was not despondent. She had led him by seductive speeches to yield him to her, and thereafter this wench had changed into the form of a goat, which bleated and said, now you see with whom you have had to do, you must be mine, or I will forthwith break your neck. Thereupon he had been frightened and trembled all over for fear. Then the transformed spirit had seized him by the throat and demanded that he should renounce God Almighty, whereupon Eunice said, God forbid. And therefore the spirit vanished through the power of these words. Yet it came straight away back, brought more people with it, and persistently demanded of him that he renounce God in heaven and all the heavenly host, by which terrible threatening he was obligated to speak this formula: I renounce God in heaven and his host, and will henceforth recognize the devil as my God. After the renunciation, he was so far persuaded by those present and by the evil spirit that he suffered himself to be otherwise baptized in the evil spirit's name. He was then named Crix, his paramour he had to call Vixen. End quote.
Okay, so he's like outside just going about his business, sees a hot lady, fucks the hot lady turns into a goat,
and he's like, oh no, that's illegal.
Oh man, I really fucked up. How could I make this mistake again? Damn it. Just out fucking goats like every day.
You're like, Johannes, this is the fourth time, it's not an accident.
Johannes, we're done. Listen, we've heard enough. We've seen enough. That's for sure.
We know that your wife is dead, but you can't keep on like this.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. The first three, we just let it slide. But this one, yeah. Okay, that's weird. And then the goat is a demon that baptizes him.
It takes him to a meeting where he's baptized. And in later portions of the trial transcript, it says Beelzebub is there. So I'm guessing that's who baptizes him.
Okay.
But, you know, it's very formulaic and very similar that, you know, the shape-shifting lover, the meeting, the denunciation, the baptism, the new names. Like I said, Walpurga's demon was Fetterlein, and she was Fetterlein. She was Hofflin. But yeah, like all of the exact same beats in the story in the same order. And I thought, like, you know, I've got to be crazy to see that these are so similar. And then I even went back into Walpurga's Wikipedia and saw that Wikipedia had compared the two of them. So this is something I had forgotten about, didn't care about, didn't know about, because I didn't know Johannes at that point. But they're like, one of the biggest similarities between them is the fact that whenever they invoke God's name, the demon will disappear and then come back.
Right.
So, you know, it's just really interesting that these stories and like the exact same plot beats will show up again.
Yeah. I wonder if anyone's like actually studied like on that deep of a level about like why they're so similar.
Yeah, I have no idea, because like I'm used to seeing like a mix of elements, like, oh, I've seen these three things in this story, I've seen this thing in 17 stories, but this is the first one that it's literally like you could just swap the names out,
right?
It's the same account. The trial notes go on to describe very briefly other meetings that Johannes has attended, who was present at those meetings, and describes an instance where his demon asked Johannes to kill his children, but Johannes killed a horse instead because he didn't want to kill his kids. And the demon beat the shit out of him.
Wow. The goat's like, that was my cousin.
It ends everything saying, quote, on August 6, 1628, there was read to the aforesaid Junius this, his confession, which he then wholly ratified and confirmed and was willing to stake his life upon it. And afterward, he voluntarily confirmed the same before the court, end quote. What is unique about Johannes? The reason I chose him, the reason why he's so documented, the reason that he stands out among the hundreds murdered in Bamberg is that he writes about what's happening to him in a letter to one of his daughters, Veronica, and he has it smuggled out of the prison.
Ooh.
So in this letter, we see that the trial notes are honest. They have tortured Johannes. He did say what he said, but it's really heartbreaking to read like a victim from a witch trial give this like firsthand account of what's going on behind the scenes in a way that like I've never got to read before. So, and I don't think I've ever read on the show before. We speculate a lot on the show, you know, like imagine this, imagine that, imagine having your breasts and hands chopped off before being burned. Imagine being abandoned in a hole or having gunpowder tied to your neck. This is the first time you really don't have to imagine anything. Cause he just tells you what he's going through. So I'm not going to read the whole letter, but I am going to read large portions of it. And that's like, when I told you my story, it was like 50% quotes. It's like, not, it's not necessarily because I was lazy. It's just like the first time I've ever had primary source material that was actually interesting. So,
yep, that's a good feeling.
So the letter opens, quote, many hundred thousand good nights, dearly beloved daughter Veronica.
Oh, stop. I'm going to cry. Okay, sorry. I could do it.
Innocent have I come into prison. Innocent have I been tortured. Innocent must I die. For whoever comes into the witch prison must become a witch or be tortured until he invents something out of his head and, God have mercy, figures out something to say. I want to tell you how things have gone for me. Johannes reports being threatened with torture, the witnesses confronting him, and what he says to each of them in turn. So in the way that the trial notes do that, like indirect kind of dialogue thing, he does direct dialogue for everything. So this is what they said exactly. This is what I said exactly. Then the letter says, quote, God in highest heaven have mercy. The executioner put the thumb screws on me, both hands bound together so that the blood ran out at the nails and everywhere, and so that 4 weeks I could not use my hands, as you can see from the writing.
Oof.
Which is the first line that like really got me, because not only mentioning like what the torture looks like from his perspective, but like having this letter and him saying like, as you can see from my handwriting, like I cannot write very well right now and I'm sorry.
Well, we haven't gotten this firsthand reflection between torture and execution before. Like this is mm-hmm. the first time. And so it is that like physical evidence of it, which is like really upsetting.
Mm-hmm. And this isn't being like pinned by anybody else. This is in like his handwriting to yeah. his daughter.
Oof.
I don't know. He then mentions something about, and I don't understand this, I'm not Christian, so I do not understand what this means, which is why I'm indirectly quoting it. Something about commending his innocence and torture to Christ's wounds so that Christ will lessen his pain and give him the strength to endure. I don't know what the commend any of that means. I just know that he keeps talking about Christ's sacred wounds.
When Jesus was on the cross, one of the last things he says was, Father, into your hands I commend my spirit. So I think it's referencing that, like I'm about to die, I'm being tortured and about to die. So like I'm equating myself mm-hmm. with Jesus's passion.
So yeah, he definitely starts talking about Christ's sacred wounds and mm-hmm. essentially like, please let me get through this.
Yeah.
He goes on, quote, thereafter they first stripped me, bound my hands behind me, and drew me up in the torture. Then I thought heaven and earth were at an end. 8 times did they draw me up and let me fall again, so that I suffered terrible agony. And this is the strapado we talked about, where you get your hands tied behind your back, and that's what they hoist you up by. Mm. And sometimes they put weights on your feet, or they hoist you up and then they let the rope slack so you fall all the way down and get caught on your arms again. Oh. And then they hoist you up again. So he's like, they did this to me 8 times.
Mm.
And no wonder he thought that like everything was over.
Yeah. Yeah.
That would hurt. So
yeah.
He does scribble in the margins around this point in the letter that, and like this has happened after everything, he just came back and he scribbled it up, that the witnesses all came to him and begged for his forgiveness before their executions for lying about him. And he's like, you know what? I get it. Like, I'm going to be forced to do the exact same thing. That's just how it works in here.
Right.
So he wanted very much to not only let his daughter know that what's going on, he's like, these other people were innocent too. Like,
mm.
They had to lie and they felt horrible about it. Mm-hmm. So Johannes keeps relaying his arguments with his torturers until, quote, I was unable to get dressed this whole time or use my hands without pain. When at last the executioner led me back into the prison, he said to me, sir, I beg you, for God's sake, confess something, whether it be true or not. Invent something, for you cannot endure the torture which you will be put to. And even if you bear it all, you will not escape, not even if you were an earl. But one torture will follow after another until you say you are a witch. Not before that, he said to me, will they let you go, as you may see by all their trials, for one is just like another.
Mm, wow.
At this point, Johannes decides that he is going to create a story. He's going to give and he's going to confess something. He asks for a priest, but he's denied a priest, but they do give him time to think. And he ultimately arrives at the conclusion that God will forgive him for his lies, because they are lies and he regrets that he has to tell them. And he didn't technically do anything that he's saying.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the people torturing him are doing wrong and technically are the ones forcing his hands into lying. So the sin falls at their feet.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Johannes writes, quote, now follows, dear child, what I confessed in order to escape the great anguish and bitter torture, which it was impossible for me longer to bear. He gives his testimony, which is, I was surprised. It's pretty accurately reflected in the court documents. One of the reasons it gets excerpted out of so many of the like versions of the letters I read is because they do like not invent anything between what he says and what they write down. So yes, I was very surprised to see that because you never really know like what the court documents are. They just like adding stuff or like they are they embellishing things.
Yeah, that's so cool that you got to like cross-reference in this case. I love that.
Yeah, so they did pretty accurately write down everything that he says. The difference is that his is mostly interspersed with the questions he's being asked and prompted to answer. So you saw that theirs was just like, this is the story that he tells. His, he's like, da-da-da-da-da, they asked me this, and I went forward and said this, da-da-da-da-da. They asked me this pressuring question, then I added this detail.
Okay, so. Yeah. And they're like, oh, yeah. Well, because that really makes you believe it.
So, okay. Yeah, you get to see the difference between, like, the unbroken story and, like, him, like, at every turn, like, this will be enough. This will satisfy them. And then they're not satisfied, and he has to add more details to it.
Well, I guess it was a goat, not a hot lady. Okay.
They keep forcing him to name accomplices, even though he tries to beg off, saying that he either didn't recognize the other people that were at the meetings or that he has bad eyesight and he couldn't see them. So he's doing his absolute best to get out of this without dragging other people down with him. But they make him go up and down the streets of Bamberg and name people from each road. And if he says he doesn't know anybody from the road or the property, they threaten to torture him again until he names somebody. So
he's just naming random people in town.
And the only people that you can name are the people that you know, like your neighbors, your friends. You can't name like second guy from the left you've never met before. So
This is upsetting. This is like people in power just want us to hate each other instead of them.
So you're kind of getting the behind the scenes on like why people are always accusing people that they know. In his case, he literally cannot name anybody other than the people that he knows.
Right.
They're the only names he has.
Right. Right. What are you going to say? It was a stranger? Like, yeah.
Just make up a name and hope it's a person and that they live there.
Like, yeah. And so in your other trials, when you're like, oh, and then she accused her mom and it's like, bitch. It's like, well,
now what
she's supposed to do.
If they're like, if you don't name a person right now, like I'm going to rip the skin off of your leg. It's like, well, right. I literally can only think of.
I can only think of my mom. So
I have a limited number of people that I know.
Yeah.
Like if they walked me through Carbondale and they're like, you have to tell me who was at the witches meeting. I don't know that many people that live in Carbondale other than my friends. So.
Yeah. Sarah was there. Mandy was there. Ashley was there. We show up in prison just like super disappointed in you.
And yeah, damn, and then it. We just do a round of drunk tarot in the cell just to make the time fly.
That sounds great to me.
When Johannes's story is not good enough, they threaten to torture him, which is when he adds the bit about being asked to kill his children and desecrating a holy wafer. Like for the most part, they were chill with this story. And then he was like, and that's all that happened. I was baptized, blah, blah, blah. And they're like, that's not good enough. What else happened? He's like, I don't know. I guess they asked me to kill my kids or something. And I killed a horse.
Yeah. They were looking for something like unforgivable.
So he's just coming up with shit. And then he's like, I took a single holy wafer, one holy wafer, and I buried it. And that's all I did.
Yeah.
Like, oh, horrible.
Well, that's funny because that's actually how you're supposed to dispose of it if it like accidentally falls on the ground.
Just go bury it?
Burying it or eating it. Like, you can't just like throw it out like into the trash. So he actually would have done the right thing.
That's so funny.
Yeah.
Just dig a hole and bury Christ in my backyard.
Yeah. Well, so like I actually have the inside scoop on this because I used to do it. But in the in like the sacristy where you are preparing like the body and blood of Christ, like mm-hmm. after communion, some like if something has fallen on the floor, if like there's tiny crumbs, like the drain in the sacristy goes right into the earth. Like it doesn't connect to the city's like water treatment system or whatever, so you can only use a tiny bit of water at a time so it doesn't just flood. Yeah, anyway,
just go wash it down into the pit of the earth, please.
Yes, exactly.
Not the regular sink, the weird pit of the earth sink.
Yes, exactly. So there's a weird pit of the earth in every Catholic church. Which makes a lot of sense.
It feels accurate.
Yeah.
I don't question it at all.
Yeah.
Anyway, after all of this extra details he adds, they're finally cool with his story and they leave him alone. They don't let him out of prison. They're just like, okay, cool. We accept your confession. Mm. In closing, Johannes writes to Veronica, quote, "Now, dear child, here you have all my confession and the record of my trial for which I must die, and they are sheer lies and inventions, so help me God. For all this I was forced to say through fear of the torture, which was threatened beyond what I had already endured. For they never leave off with the torture till one confesses something. No matter how pious he really is, he must be a witch. Nobody escapes." He speaks about being a martyr and not a witch. He goes on this entire thing about, like, make sure people know that, like, I was a martyr. I may have confessed, but they were lies. Like, please do not believe, daughter, that I was actually a witch. I promise that I was not a witch. Mm-hmm. He instructs his daughter to get out of the area, which is, like, a really sweet moment. He's like, get some money together, go on a pilgrimage, just wait it out outside the city, see how like things go in the next couple of years, but just get out of here. Mm-hmm. And he finishes, quote, "Dear child, keep this letter secret so that it does not circulate," which is really funny because now it's on the internet. "Otherwise I will be tortured so severely that it does not bear thinking about, and the jailers will be beheaded. So strictly is it forbidden." Says that she can let her cousin read the letter, asks that she and her sister pray for him, again swears that he is innocent to her, and also asks, "Dear child, please pay this man. I have taken several days to write this." So presumably whoever has delivered the letter and smuggled it out for her. Mm-hmm. Johannes is burned August 6th, 1628. The Bamberg trials kill conservatively an estimate of 300 to 600 people. Larger estimates lean over 1,000, but I think those estimates might be including cases on Bamberg that happened before 1626. Mm. This trial's been going on for a while, so if you add up like the ones that happened here or there for the previous, like, what, four decades, they probably add up. Mayors were killed, councilmen, kids, women who just given birth, apparently, in the case of Dorothea. And I wish I could say something horrible happened to the people in charge, but that is not how these stories work. Quote, "Good night, for your father, Johannes Junius, will never see you again. July 24th, 1628, end quote, is how his letter to his daughter ends. And that is the story of Johannes Junius and the Bamberg trials.
Oh my God. That one hit me hard. Definitely the primary source material makes you think about it even more, makes them become real people in your mind, mm-hmm. like a real person who was suffering physical effects of torture. And I hope his daughter got out of town. I hope she survived. I hope she like had a family. It just makes me so mad that, like, what was the point of all of that? Like, who started it and why? And, like, you know, like, who picked him and was like, he's a witch? And then everybody was just like, okay. Like,
and it was just another mayor that named him. But that was one of the people who profusely apologized to him in the Druden House, was just like, I'm so sorry. Like, you're just one of the names that I knew. You're one of the names that I had.
Yeah. It's just like a snowball effect. Man, that fucking sucks.
It
does. Why'd you tell me that story? Why are we doing this?
It was hard to write jokes into my side of the episode at all the second I decided that, like, oh, I actually have a letter from a victim. Like, I have to read a majority of this. And it's like, how do I intersperse this with our bullshit? And I'm like, you know what? I'm just going to say our old episode titles. That'll be my humor for the
day.
That
was kind of like the lighter side of the episode. But like, I feel that pain with, like, I was thinking about, like, St. Margaret, the one who got, like, pressed to death. And I was like, what do I fucking do? Like, this is tragedy.
You don't want to be, like, not sensitive to what's going on, like, the tragedy. But also, like, you can't just be completely serious. Like, you gotta pull out of that pit of despair a little bit. So
yeah, a little bit. You gotta, like, take a peek above the surface of the pit of despair. Well, what I like about this, that story, is that, like, we're talking about it, so anyone who listens will know, like, almost like keeping his memory alive, that he was innocent. And, like, so if you happen upon his name somewhere at a different time, you can be like, oh, that guy, like, he wasn't evil, he wasn't in league with the devil, like, he was just tortured. So I think that's good.
It makes me wish that we had more letters from more victims, because, like, his was so unique, you know, just, like, talking about addressed to his daughter and, like, how much he loved her, and, like, talking about his faith the entire time.
Yeah.
And just how much he directly quoted stuff. So I would love to have more letters from victims to see how they recorded what was going on with them.
Yeah. And I think that a lot of them probably did have the exact same impulse, and maybe even did write letters in prison. It's just they never got a chance to have them smuggled out. He was just, like, lucky that someone happened to be willing to do that. Probably because he was, like, in power. Yeah.
Yeah. It really sucks how many, like, firsthand accounts of things that we've lost. But at least we have this one. At least there's this one. And at least that it got smuggled out successfully, and it was kept intact long enough to, like, be put into archives.
Yeah, that's crazy.
Because she could have been like, oh, my last thing from my father, folds it up into a book and lets it decay forever and ever.
That's what I would do. Just, oops, whatever. Yeah, that's true. That's crazy. It's still around. That was good. So I kind of had to stifle a grin when you brought up Walpurga, because guess who I'm doing?
Who?
Saint Walpurga.
Really?
Really? I had heard of her before you mentioned her in, I think it was episode 10. You were like, oh, you should do Walpurga sometime when we come back to Germany. And I was like, nah, whatever.
I do what I want.
Exactly. But so I only knew her name. Like, I'd heard her name. I didn't really know anything else about her. But apparently this is going to be the third episode in a row in which the theme of my half of the episode is, like, look at all the things that Christianity has stolen from paganism.
Yay!
So I will talk about the origins of the holiday Walpurgisnacht, and we will also look at the pagan archetype of Grandmother, and how Saint Walpurga and actually a surprising amount of female saints could fit into that role. But before that, we will get some facts about St. Walpurga's life, because she actually had an interesting one. Her family was not the typical Dark Ages family. So she was actually born in what would later be known as England. Her nationality was Anglo-Saxon. She was born in Devon around the year 710 into an aristocratic family. Her father was Richard of Wessex. I think it's so funny. Walpurga, daughter of Richard.
Even better if they call him something like Dick.
Daughter of Dick, yeah.
Dick's daughter, Walpurga.
Walpurga Dick's daughter. That's what it would be if it was Swedish or whatever. Wow, that was offensive.
It's funny, though.
Offensive on many levels. But yeah, pretty funny. So yeah, her dad was Richard of Wessex, later known as Saint Richard the Pilgrim. He was an underking of West Saxony. And her mother, Wuna, W-U-N-A, would later become Saint Wuna of Wessex. Unfortunately, her mom did die shortly after Walpurga's birth. I'm not sure if she died like in childbirth or from complications of childbirth, but her death year is the same year as Walpurga's birth year. So like, I just kind of assumed it was related, but it might not have been. Wuna's brother, some historians believe, was Saint Boniface, whom we'll talk about later in the story. He has his whole own set of adventures. Walpurga had two older brothers who are named Willibald and Winibald. both of them would also become saints. So the entire family, which is a bit much, it's giving like all blonde family energy, which obviously is terrifying. Very threatening aura.
Imagine being the black sheep because you're the only not saint in your family.
Yeah, that would be pretty awkward. Like a random youngest sibling is just like the worst.
And that's Carolyn over there.
And that's Carolyn.
She's just doing her own stuff.
She's doing her best. I don't like to talk about Carolyn. She's okay. Like, don't look at her. Yeah, so they're like an all blonde family. It's very threatening. So like, why are they all saints? What did they do to merit that? I read the oldest English Vita that I could find the full text of, which is unfortunately from 1873. And this was in the 9th century that all this stuff happened. So like, we're pretty far removed. So I read the 1873 Life of Saint Walburg, Saint Mark Walburg. there are so many variations of her name. It's like, I think the original was maybe Swedish because she's Anglo-Saxon. So like she has Viking ancestry. So like Valborg was like probably her, like the original pronunciation of her name, so we have all kinds of spellings of it and everything. I say Walpurga just because that's what it looks like and I'm lazy. So I read the Life of Saint Walburg by Father Thomas Myrick, I'm assuming. He was an Irish Jesuit. And the text of that hagiography was written in response to an ongoing miracle that is associated with Saint Walpurga. The hagiography also included a translation of a text called the Hodoporicon of Saint Willibald. I learned a new word. Hodoporicon means a relation of voyage. So that is
that'll come up every day in conversation for me.
You could talk about your day, just call it your Hodoporicon. This is where I traveled today.
I will drop that into my conversations with my Walmart coworkers for sure.
That's very classist of you. JK, I like making fun of people too. So it's the story of Saint Willibald's pilgrimage, which I will talk about later. So finally, I read a few chapters of the book, The Goddess Obscured, Transformation of the Grain Protectress from Goddess to Saint by Pamela Berger, which is what I'll be quoting from when I talk about what?
Pam Berger.
Oh, no. Pam Berger.
I'm sorry.
It's okay. It's, look, it's a good joke. This is a great joke even. But I need you to stop anyway.
Okay.
How did I not? How did I miss that? Hamburger. My life.
I hope everybody in her life calls her that.
I hope not for her sake, although it would be kind of a cute nickname.
Hamburger.
It would. Yeah. So yeah, I'll be quoting from that book when I talk about the pagan influences and the source material that has been repurposed into Christian stories.
Okay.
Set the scene. Again, Walpurga's mother is dead. She never knows her mother, I would assume. King Richard and the three children, Willibald, Winibald, and Walpurga, are living in Devon. King Richard was a religious man. When Willibald, who was the oldest, was 3 years old, he got very sick, and Richard actually successfully prayed for his recovery by, he like placed him in front of this big cross in the middle of town for like all to see, and like said a prayer that if Willibald recovered, that he would dedicate him to God. So at the age of five, ripe old age of five, Willibald is sent to the monastery. He would later become a monk. And in the year 721, when Walpurga was 11 years old, the monk Willibald, who was then 21, convinced his father Richard and his brother Winibald, who was 19, that the three of them, Richard and his two sons, should go on a pilgrimage to see the tombs of the apostles in Rome. And Richard's like, sounds great. I don't have any other children. Perfect. Nope. And Walpurga's like, hi. He's like, oh, you. So before they left, King Richard entrusted Walpurga to the abbess at Wimburn Abbey in Dorset. This was a Benedictine double monastery, so both monks and nuns lived there, and they followed the rule of Saint Benedict, which is the offices of prayer throughout the day and night. The abbey had actually been founded by two of Walpurga's female relatives on her mother's side, either by donation of land or money or both. It's not really clear. So the three guys go off on their adventure while Walpurga is just chilling at the monastery. Richard had actually abdicated, so he was no longer an under-king of West Saxony. He had sold his entire estate as well, and he and his sons set sail from Hamblehaven, I think, which I guess is near Southampton, which is shockingly in the south of England.
Really?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So they set sail, they land in France, they stay for a short time in Rouen. Rouen, that place that you love.
Mm-hmm. So much.
And then they set off on the pilgrimage path toward Italy, which is called the Via Francigena, I think, in Italian, meaning the road that comes from France. It is an ancient pilgrimage route from Canterbury to Rome through France and Switzerland. And then once in Rome, obviously, you have the option to extend your trip and go all the way to the Holy Land and take a boat there. So the three of them do make it all the way to Italy, but Richard, unfortunately, does not make it to Rome. In the city of Lucca, all three of them get sick with a fever. The Hodoporicon says it's the Black Plague. Historians say it's malaria. Anyway, Richard dies. He was buried in the church of San Frediano, and that's where his cult began after miracles were reported at his grave. I didn't look into that much, so I don't know what the miracles were or when they happened, but that's how people started to notice him, I guess.
How do you explain that to your sister? Like, we convinced Dad to go on a family vacation. He died.
And he died, and then we just kept going. We just ditched him. We buried him. And we moved the fuck on.
We patted the dirt. We said, okay, Dad.
Okay, sounds good. Guess we're done. All right, better head out. So yeah, they keep going. They finish the pilgrimage to Rome. Winnebald, the younger one, had been, I guess, more weakened by the disease. So he decides he's not going to keep going to the Holy Land. He's going to stay in Rome and continue his studies. Willibald is like, I feel great. I kicked malaria's ass. I'm ready to get on the ship. So Willibald had many adventures on his pilgrimage. He saw all the sights. He did get himself into a bit of a pickle at one point where a bishop's soldiers thought that he was a spy and arrested him. but they worked it out and they set him free. You know, boys will be boys. He continued on his way. He went to Damascus and Galilee and Cana and Bethlehem, all the New Testament hotspots. His pilgrimage to the Holy Land, not even including the original trip from England to Italy, but just the Holy Land. He was there for 7 years.
He took vacation to another level.
Look, when he says vacation, what he really means is just abandoning his entire family, like watching his father die, going on a very incredible trip. Like, it's like a whole season of his life.
How did he get that much PTO?
I think when you're a monk, they let you take that much.
Just go have fun.
Just
we'll see pretend... when you get back.
Yeah, exactly. I don't think he ever gets back. not to England, anyway. So upon his return to Italy, he joined the Benedictine community at Monte Cassino, I think, which is about 80 miles southeast of Rome. And he stayed there for about 10 years, just teaching and eventually becoming the dean. Like, this guy had a whole life. He saw it all. And then in 738, Saint Boniface, who is again, probably his uncle, St. Boniface came to Rome and asked the Pope if the Pope would send Willibald to assist him in his missions in Germany, or the area that would later become Germany. So Boniface had established lots of different missions in Germany and Francia, or is it Franconia at this point? I don't remember. And I don't care enough to figure it out right now. But the area that was once Gaul, he had established missions there under the protection of the Carolingians, who were the dynasty that kind of took over after the Merovingians, which was like King Clovis and Saint Clotilde, those guys. So Boniface could be his own episode entirely, so I won't go into a ton of detail about him, but he's one of those gray figures. Depends on your point of view if he's good or bad. His epithet is the apostle to the Germans. He was at least partially responsible for paving the way for Christianity to become the dominant religion in Central Europe during this point between like the Gallo-Roman Empire and the like the full-on Middle Ages. So he wanted Willibald to come to the mission at Eichstätt in, you said Bavaria? Mm-hmm. Is that right? I always heard Bavaria, but you're probably right. That's probably actually how it's pronounced.
I would have said Bavaria looking at it, but mm-hmm. I feel like the reason it's Bavaria in the back of my head is probably that I looked up the German pronunciation at some point.
Yeah, probably. So he wants him to come to the mission at Eichstätt, but there was no monastery there yet. There was just like a tiny little chapel in the woods and then just like a bunch of land. So Willibald and Boniface, two just stellar names. I love those names. They drew up their plans for a monastery at Eichstätt together. And then Boniface consecrated Willibald a priest there in 741. So Willibald gets things started over at Eichstätt, and a year later, Boniface summons him to a different monastery in Thuringia, and guess who just happens to be the abbot of this other monastery? His brother, Winnebald, whom he has not seen in about 18 years.
He's like, dude, parted ways, and you just fucking fell off the face of the earth. He's like, fuck?
I thought you were dead.
I've been telling everybody you were dead.
I told literally everybody I know that you were dead. So this is interesting. This is fun. Hi. Yeah. So it's at this monastery in Thuringia where Willibald is made bishop at the age of 41. After that, he returned to supervise the construction at Eichstätt. He and his brother oversaw the construction of many Benedictine monasteries in Thuringia and Bavaria and throughout Central Europe. So when we see like a couple hundred years later, like Saint Hildegard and Saint Bernard, who were contemporaries living in their like Benedictine convents, this is where it all started, was these guys. They're sometimes referred to as the Athletes of Christ, which is really dorky. Sounds like a high school basketball team or something. Like, not my favorite. But they did a lot of work. Were they athletic? I don't know.
Well, with as much traveling as they did, as much walking.
That's true. They probably walked a lot.
Their Fitbits are like, how are you alive?
Literally, how are you surviving? Just drinking beers and walking through the desert. What a life. So they're building these double monasteries. They're like preaching to the locals. And then like in the true fashion of men, bless their hearts, after like years of work, they look around and they realize like, oh, hey, we built these things for monks and nuns, but there aren't any nuns here. It's like, yeah, you didn't invite any. Like,
it's like a grad program. They're like, why are there so many men in this grad program?
Didn't admit any women, you fucker. Yeah. So they're like, where are we going to get nuns from?
Where are we going to get women?
Where do women even live?
Where does one find a woman?
Hypothetically, if one were to go hunting for a woman to take to a secluded place in the forest, it's not like that.
To marry Jesus.
To marry Jesus. Yeah, exactly.
Where would one find those women?
Hypothetically. Yeah. So then they're like, oh, yeah, we have a sister. She's a nun. And she lives with other nuns. Perfect. So in 748, they send for Walpurga, who has lived at Wimburne Abbey in Dorset for about 30 years.
Her family went on vacation and just straight up ditched her.
Never came back. They went out for cigarettes 30 years ago and never came back. Yeah, she's had no news of her family for 30 years, nothing. Like, completely made peace with the fact that her entire family is dead and she's alone.
She gets a random letter and they're like, hey, so we were kind of stupid and we need you to fix it.
Exactly. 100%. Yeah, so she's about 40 years old when her abbess receives that letter. And I can't even imagine. Like, I don't know how she really reacted. I want to know how she truly reacted to it. Because, of course, the hagiography is like, oh, she was overjoyed and immediately dedicated herself to the task at hand and making preparations for her departure. It's like, I'm sure she sat there for a second and was like,
what?
What? I don't know how she even believed that it was true. Mm-hmm. I don't know. But so she does leave. 30 nuns accompanied her to Germany. And this abbey that she was at, Wimburne Abbey, they make a point of saying how huge it was. Like, there were like 500 people living there, so they could spare like 30 nuns. A few of the nuns that went with her also ended up becoming saints. Saint Thecla is the only name that I recognized, but I know there were a few more. The voyage began smoothly, but their ship did run into a violent storm on the open sea. We've heard this story before. We know how it goes. Walpurga commanded the sea to be calm, and it obeyed her.
But it was not weather magic, because she's...
because... I don't know where we draw the line.
Me neither.
Maybe because she's associated with holy men. Like men we can point to and be like, they're definitely a saint. Like they're definitely on our side. So we can then say that she is too.
I guess.
Like, where is the line? I don't know. So that's like the only detail we get of the journey, which is funny because we get so many anecdotes about Willibald's pilgrimage, but none really about Walpurgis. There's the storm and then suddenly they're in Germany. Hello. Walpurga is reunited with her two brothers after 30 years. She is then assigned to become the superioress of one of Winibald's monasteries. He actually had 7 that he was in charge of. So he needed a little help, maybe overcommitted on that one. He's like, I'm just now asking myself internally, in quite a worried way, whether I've made an error. So what was I saying? Yes. The text said that it was common at the time and in the area for female superioresses to rule over men in a double monastery because women were actually perceived as being more receptive to quote unquote prophetical gifts and supernatural communications. I'll take it. The hagiography is extremely romanticized in the way it discusses the conversion of souls in Central Europe, which is not really surprising. So it'll be like, oh, the Anglo-Saxon missionaries were bringing the gift of Christianity back to the land of their ancestors. It's like, I mean, nobody asked for it, but okay. Yeah, I wouldn't say it was a gift, but it happened. So anyway, Winibald and Walpurga are very successful in their efforts with the support of the dukes and bishops and archbishops of the area, despite the hostility from some of the native or pagan inhabitants. They got lucky. Several monks and nuns were martyred in this time period, including Saint Boniface himself, who started the whole thing. So there was real danger, and the fact that they were so successful was seen as like a huge accomplishment. I just think they kind of got lucky. So in the monastery where Winibald and Walpurga end up spending like most of their time is called Heidenheim, which they founded together in the year 752. Heidenheim was deep in the Black Forest, so like as you can imagine, they have to cut down a few trees to build it. The locals were not fond of the tree cutting. The hagiography brings up that very good point, and then immediately dismisses it and says, well, but they reconciled eventually. It's like, did they? What really happened? They probably didn't just shake hands, I wouldn't imagine. So about 10 years after the founding of Heidenheim, Winibald died on the 8th of December, 761, at the age of 60. He had been ill often ever since that illness he caught in Italy on the pilgrimage. I think it just like stayed with him. Again, I don't know what it was. Like, I don't know, I didn't look it up, if malaria does that to you. Like, if you survive, will you still have like some strain of it in you? I don't know. But so he dies, and he had been really ill for the final few years of his life, like in bed all the time. The hagiography says, quote, the love of Saint Walpurga for her saintly brother was great, and the separation from him by his death made the remainder of her life desolate. As he lay dying, he commended, another theme, he commended both the monks and the nuns to her care. She mourned for his loss, not only because he was her brother, but her guide and director in sanctity, and because the duties and responsibilities of government, by wish of the dying abbot and command of the bishop, now devolved upon her. She was appointed to take charge of both the monastery and convent of Heidenheim, and this duty she fulfilled for 15 years. The writer of the hagiography says that it's suspected that this is the time when Walpurga wrote the biographies of her brothers. So like the whole story of like Willibald's pilgrimage. The writer of this hagiography thinks that Walpurga actually wrote it. I guess that's a disagreement because it's attributed to a different nun at Heidenheim. But people are like, well, she was closest to them, so it makes the most sense that she wrote it, but we're not sure. But if she did write it, she probably wrote it around this time period. It's also during her time as the superioress of Heidenheim that we get the stories of miracles that she's associated with. So I'll talk about three of them and then transition into the idea of like the grandmother and how those old legends were repurposed. So this is the first miracle during this time period. Quote, after her brother's death, she remained on one occasion a long time to pray in the church of the monastery. Night was closing in, and she asked for a light to retire to her cell. The sacristan refused it her, and without making any reply or resenting the contempt of her authority, she went to her chamber, the angels giving a light to her path, and a bright supernatural light from the cell of St. Walpurga lit up the whole convent through the night until the hour of matins. This miracle she ascribed to the intercession of St. Winibald. Nifty. Angel lantern. Another miracle is related of her during her lifetime, while she was abbess, after the death of St. Winibald. The daughter of a neighboring lord was dying. Her parents were in the greatest affliction, and the father, who was a rough huntsman, unmindful of the chase, sat full of grief. St. Walpurga, acquainted with their misfortune and feeling for their sorrows, received an impulse to visit them. It was in the evening when she approached the castle, and the hungry wolfhound surrounded the door. The master of the house, being told that a stranger stood without, bid her be called in lest the savage dog should tear her down. On receiving the message, she replied, "Do not fear, the hounds will not hurt Walpurga." When the baron heard that it was the abbess of Heidenheim, he came to receive her with respect, and being told that she was come to visit his dying child, accompanied her to the chamber. There she remained through the night in prayer, and in the morning restored their daughter in health to her parents. In gratitude, they offered her rich presents, which she refused. So probably the most famous miracle associated with Walpurga was that of her bones, her relics. So she died on the 25th of February, 776, which, stick a pin in that date, come back to that later. But she was buried in like a rocky hillside, I believe, or there were rocks on her grave or something to mark it. And eventually, visitors to her grave noticed a sort of oil leaking from the grave, like out from the rocks. So what do you do when you notice some weird sludge dripping out of a grave? That's obviously, it. You grab it and you rub it all over your face and hands and body.
Yep.
Obviously. So it was discovered to have miraculous properties. It could heal the sick, restore sight to the blind, all that good stuff. And this miracle in particular was really what helped amass her huge following at the time. And it's the reason that the very first hagiography was written about her in 895. So those are what's mentioned in the hagiography, but there are more stories about her miracles which don't appear in that text. So I turn now to the book, The Goddess Obscured by Pam Berger. So the idea of the grain mother or grain protectress, which I was stumbling over that word so much when I was like practicing protectress, I just couldn't get it out. The idea is seen in pretty much all cultures across like the entire world. It's like, this is a fundamental figure. In the Roman pantheon, we have the goddess of harvest and grain. I can't pronounce her name because I didn't look it up. Ceres. I don't know, but apparently that's where the word cereal comes from. So that's fun. The goddess of harvest and grain. She taught humans how to properly store grain because, again, we fucked it up. We were getting real high on bread mold. Bad shit was happening. In the Greek pantheon, obviously, we have Demeter. in the ancient Egyptian religion, Osiris is sort of an androgynous deity who teaches humans when to plant in accordance with the flooding of the Nile. In Hinduism, Parvati is celebrated as a goddess of the harvest and a protector of women. And then, of course, there's the Celtic Brigid. There's too many to name all of them. It's literally everywhere. Pamberger argues in her book that, quote, human survival depended on the spontaneous produce of the soil, and ancient agriculturalists stood in awe of that life-producing power. When the hoe or plow entered the womb of the earth and the seed was sown, a new process of creation was initiated, all under the protection of the grain mother. So after that, she discusses how the very first signs of this kind of figure come from like the Neolithic era, like before civilization was even a thing. And by the time we even get to like ancient Greece, which in itself is so long ago, the legends and rituals have already been watered down and put in a patriarchal context to the extent that like Demeter, for example, is just a shadow of the earlier like harvest figure. And of course that just gets even more watered down when the legends are repurposed in Christian terms. So she also makes a really good point that we've lost most of the original essence of these stories and beliefs because ritual objects like statues or offerings to these figures were made of the available materials like straw or wood or mud. Like these were made by farmers who were praying for a harvest. So they served a purpose and then they decomposed. So the earliest surviving records are not early enough for us to fully comprehend the significance of the grain mother figure. She continues discussing how this shift in incorporation happened. She writes, quote, "The literate Latin clerical culture was consistently opposed to ceremonies dedicated to the grain goddess. Practiced by unlettered peasants, these rites and other agrarian customs were nevertheless vigorously maintained. The language churchmen use to describe peasants taking part in these rites is derogatory. The cleric's unremitting castigation of the grain goddess and her rites served as an ironic proof that she continued to be venerated. Reluctant to abandon such a deeply rooted mythic figure, early medieval peasants sought ways to retain the grain protectress while rendering her innocuous to the church hierarchy. In some cases, the Earth Mother became part of folk pageants celebrated at seeding time. In other areas, popular imagination invented new forms of the figure or syncretized her, that is, attempted to see her as or combine her with a Christian saint." And again, this is obviously a huge part of why Christianity became the dominant religion of Europe. It allowed itself to be syncretic in order to gain as many followers as possible. So Walpurga and a few other female saints undergo this process. Even the Virgin Mary in some cultures undergoes this process of getting folded into the legend in the form of a story that goes pretty much the exact same way every time. The saint or goddess passes by a field at sowing time. She demonstrates some kind of growing power. She effects a miracle over the plowman or herself or both. And then all those participating or observing are protected from harm and a successful harvest ensues. That's the basic story. So this is Walpurga's version of the story. So first of all, the earliest representations of Walpurga are found in an 11th century illustrated manuscript called the Hitda, I'm not sure, codex. And in that illustration, Walpurga is holding stalks of grain. Some scholars refer to it as a palm branch, but a palm branch is reserved for to signify a martyr. So like Saint Philomena is always depicted with a palm branch, but Walpurga wasn't a martyr, so that doesn't make sense. So it's a stalk of grain, not a palm branch. So here's the story. One night, a farmer who feared it was going to rain was bringing his harvest home on a wagon. Suddenly, he encountered Saint Walpurga. She was fleeing and asked the peasant if he would hide her among his sheaves of grain, for her enemy was following close behind. The peasant accepted and hid the saint in a sheaf. Hardly was the saint hidden when the fiendish white rider came by. The peasant quickly made the sign of the cross and was happy when the danger was past. Saint Walpurga climbed out of the grain sheaf, thanked the peasant, and told him to watch carefully over his grain. The peasant continued home, and the next morning he was overjoyed to find that his grain had turned to gold. So this is definitely a case of like a syncretic folktale, which was allowed to exist in this new Christianized form by the clergy. They're like, okay, if it's a saint, it's okay if you like believe this story, because then it's a miracle. Another way in which Walpurga has been syncretized with the pagan legends is the date on which her feast was celebrated. I mentioned earlier that she died on February 25th, and that is technically her feast day. But before the first hagiography was written about her, her feast was celebrated on May 1st, May Day, Beltane. This was the day on which Walpurga's relics were translated from Heidenheim to Eichstätt in 870. So May 1st was 100% knowingly, like strategically chosen as the day to move those relics in a public ceremony in order to coincide with May Day. Obviously, May Day has been associated with fertility rituals all throughout history, the earliest known celebrations being the Roman festival of Floralia, celebrating Dionysus and Aphrodite. The feast of Saint Walpurga is still celebrated on the eve of May Day, and it's referred to as Walpurgisnacht or Walpurgis Night or Saint Walpurga's Eve. It's celebrated all over Europe, but particularly in Germanic countries. In Germany, it's also referred to as Hexenacht or Witch's Night, when witches are said to hold their celebrations and await the coming of spring. Traditions include bonfires to ward off evil spirits, or even pilgrimages to Eichstätt to obtain vials of Walpurga's oil. Walpurga is the patron saint of protection from witchcraft, as well as the harvest and healings of multiple ailments. She's also a patroness of pregnant women, just further cementing the fertility symbolism and syncretism. The monastery at Eichstätt still exists. Walpurga is buried there alongside her two brothers and some of the remains of her father. Willibald, the oldest brother, outlived Walpurga by about 10 years, and the three siblings and their parents were all canonized in the 9th century by Pope Adrian II. And that is Saints Walpurga, Willibald, Winibald, Wuna, and Richard the Pilgrim, and an example of the syncretization of the Grain Mother mythology that continues to this day.
You really didn't pick one saint. You're like, let's see how many saints I can shoehorn into one episode.
Well, I knew I wanted to do Walpurga, and then I was like, so damn, funny. There's so many.
I do remember whenever I looked her up initially. I forget why I looked her up. Maybe it was because I was doing Walpurga and I wanted to see if she was related to Walpurgisnacht. Mm-hmm. But I do remember whenever I clicked on Walpurga a year and a half ago, all like the blue names in the Wikipedia article. It's like, Jesus fucking Christ, how many saints are you associated with?
Yeah. And I, for all the ones, all the other ones besides her, I just did like the bare minimum of research. So I'm sure there's like a lot more. Willibald had the most about him because he had that whole like voyage. But the other ones, there is a pretty good amount of information about them. I just didn't read it.
And if you tried to say all of it, it would just continue to like spiderweb out and out and out. So
yeah, I knew I wanted like, okay, I want to know what they're all doing while they're apart so that they can reunite and like you can know like who they are at least. But
then it turns out what they were doing was just dying and convincing their siblings they were dead on accident.
Exactly. Yeah.
What a family.
Yeah, a bunch of weirdos. Imagine that though, like you're just fully convinced that your entire family is dead. It's like, nope, you still have two brothers and they are alive.
I would be happy to see them and then smack them within the same 30 seconds. It's like 40 years, 40 fucking years.
Right. You couldn't write one letter in 40 years.
I lost your address.
The address was the place where you dropped me off at the age of 11.
Like, I didn't expect you to just stay there, because I mean, we kind of did the opposite of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I do think it's so interesting how like the men were allowed to go wherever they wanted and she was just stuck with the other nuns.
Chilling.
Mm-hmm. She could only leave like when she had a man's permission. Lame.
Very lame.
Yeah.
Interesting story though. I'm always interested to see when things are syncretic, where they match up. And it's interesting because I always wondered what she had to do with May Day. And now I know. It just turns out that's when they moved her shit. So
yeah, I don't think it's anything to do with anything she did during her life. I think it was just convenient for her to be associated with that. Like, there's nothing from the story of her life that tells us that she was associated with the harvest or fertility at all. Like, I mean, she saved that girl that one time. She healed a girl, you know? It's like, okay. Yeah, it was just an easy, convenient way to pull a switcheroo on people.
I'm glad I know more about her, though, now. And her family, her weird family.
Yeah, there's definitely like a story in there that I'm gonna steal about like one sibling being separated from the others for decades and then meeting them again. Like, it would be so crazy. You wouldn't even know what they look like anymore.
And the first thing they do is ask you for a favor.
Hey, so now that you're here, now that you've eaten...
Not that I'm not happy to see you or anything, but did have an agenda for contacting
you. This is a very dire situation. We are being hunted. They want to murder us. They hate us here. That would suck to walk into.
Mm-hmm.
That shit show. Oh, Germany.
Always up to some bullshit.
Mm-hmm.
Can always rely on them for that.
Yeah. How should we celebrate? I have some soft pretzels in the freezer. I'm gonna heat one of those up. Old German style theme. Do they eat soft pretzels there?
I don't know. I'm assuming.
Right.
I don't think we have exclusive rights to soft pretzels.
Well, right. I wasn't implying that. Oh God. Before I die, we should sign off. We now have a, what's it called? What do they call it? On our end, it says listener support. I'm not sure what it says on like all the different platforms, but anyway, we now have a function where you can donate to the podcast if you feel like it. I think you can set up monthly donations, so you could be like, hey, whenever an episode comes out, I'll donate $1. Basically just to cover maybe the purchase of ebooks or beer or sangria.
We do,
or whatever,
a lot for free. I mean, hours and hours of research go into every episode. We sit here for hours and talk about it, and then we edit the audio. But yeah, if you want to throw a dollar our way, just a crisp dollar.
Sir, may I please have just a single dollar? I feel That's so pathetic it. Asking for money. I feel like a little orphan boy with my hat out. It feels lame. But you know, we do a lot of work on this podcast for free.
And we're going to keep doing it.
Yeah.
But if you appreciate our nonsense and you want to buy us like a third of a coffee, then third of a coffee.
Yeah, that'd be good. An espresso.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the thing with like our podcast is like it's very, very amateur. And I mean, I think that's a good thing. Like, I don't think amateur stuff is always bad. Yeah, yeah. But like other podcasts, they have researchers, they have editors, they have a sound person. It is literally just us and two computers.
And we just figure it out.
And we make it work. Yeah, I think that's it for our announcements. Okay, you know how to get in touch with us. It's in the episode description. And we will see you next time. Thanks be to God.
Blessed be.